In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Live from Liverpool, The Dark Paranormal, Season 20.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to Episode 2 of Season 20 of The Dark Paranormal. Today, we are going to take a look at a topic that creeps up rather frequently, but a more in-depth look at this particular topic. The topic in question is that of possession. But before we do so, a huge thank you for everyone for your comments and feedback regarding our debut episode of Season 20. And although we now have changed how you submit your experience, i.e. via the website in the links in the show notes, or by visiting the website thedarkparanormal.com, and then clicking on Submit Your Experience, the contact at the Dark Paranormal email address is still open for people to provide their feedback and their suggestions. Never think or believe for one moment this show is set. It's always in a state of flux. It will always be shaped by you because this show is for you. So if you think the show is heading in a direction you don't like, just let me know, and we change it. It's your show. I want to enjoy doing the show, and I want you to enjoy hearing the show. So if you do wish to add some feedback regarding the show, the contact at the Dark Paranormal email address is always open, and I will receive each and every one of those emails. Because any success this show has had has been down to that back and forth, to the malleability we're able to give the show, and to how much we put control in your hands. So please do use that. As we mentioned last week, this is our 20th anniversary season. It's also our 5th anniversary year as a show, and therefore we want this season to be full of surprises. And our next big surprise will be coming next week. But more on that next week. Now, today, as I mentioned, we will be talking about possession. Because today's experience is in that ballpark, and it's that phrase, in that ballpark, I want to address. So we very often will jump to possession from nothing. However, at least in the eyes of the Catholic Church, who deal with the Roman ritual version of an exorcism, that's not how possession works. It gradually becomes a possession. And it's interesting how many cases we may have covered as possession, which we're not. Today, we are dealing with a case which I do not believe is a full-blown possession. It's more in between the penultimate and final stage. You may recall we covered a case of the demon named Lovelace, and it was a harrowing experience for the person who submitted the story, obviously. And you will see similarities in today's experience. However, from looking at the steps that lead to full-blown possession, I believe both today's case and the demon called Lovelace were, as I said, I think that was a case also of someone between the penultimate and final step. So very quickly, I want to run through those steps with you as an education for both me and for anyone else who is unaware of how this is meant to work. And it does two things. One, we'll be better able to spot which stage of a particular experience may not be a possession, but two, it also makes the experiences which we've believed have not been that terrifying a bit more terrifying. You'll see what I mean when I begin. So, it apparently begins with infestation, which is unexplained knocking or scratching, objects moving of their own accord, Foul smells, cold spots, temperature drops, shadow figures, fleeting glimpses, animals reacting with fear, etc. Now, we've covered many tales which have those features. And we may say, well, we get this most episodes, shadow figures, etc. Yet, it's the first step, allegedly, to possession. Secondly, we have oppression, which includes sudden onset of severe depression or anxiety, suicidal thoughts or urges, nightmares, night terrors or sleep paralysis, persistent bad luck or illness with no medical explanation, hearing whispers or footsteps, but not voices, emotional withdrawal or isolation, inexplicable rage, anger or mood swings. Again, we've heard all of that before in previous episodes and never mentioned possession. Next comes obsession. Intrusive, involuntary, blasphemous or violent thoughts, persistent thoughts of self-harm or harming others, hearing voices mocking, threatening or instructing harmful acts, paranoia, fear or despair with no reason, fixation on death, demons or dark imagery, extreme aversion to sacred things, compulsive behavior that feels externally driven, and finally, possession. Speaking in unknown or ancient languages, superhuman strength, knowledge of hidden things, eyes rolling back or becoming black or white, multiple or distorted voices coming from the person, violent physical reactions to prayers, holy water or religious items, periods of unconsciousness or amnesia, and distorted facial expressions or bodily contortions not possible under normal conditions. And I do apologize, the intro to this experience is rather lengthy, but I think it's very important that we realize some of the experiences that we've covered where we may have thought nothing much happened there. But that experience will have contained symptoms from either stage one or two, potentially leading to something deeply dark. But before we hit our experience for today, a very quick shout out to our wonderful team over at Patreon who allow this show to remain on this feed for free. Head over to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal, and by joining our wonderful team, you can enjoy each of these episodes ad-free and before anyone else, and you can also gain access to the full back catalogue of Dark Bites, our weekly Patreon-only show, which is 30 minutes in length and covers a plethora of stories every single week of the year. And also, of course, you'll join our fantastic community. And genuinely, if I was not the host, I'd be a member. We've built a wonderful community of like-minded, kind, paranormal enthusiasts who like nothing better but to openly and open-mindedly debate the paranormal. And if that sounds like you, head over to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal. Due to the length of today's introduction, I'll move the names of the newest team members to the end of the show for this week, and we'll be back to the start of the show for next week. But right now, it's time. Lower the lights. Make yourself comfortable, and most importantly, leave your disbelief at the door. As we hear all about the Scratchy Man. My submission is 100% real, and I'm hoping your experience might help. All names, including my own, are changed, as are the streets and the house names as well. The only real name is where this took place, Glastonbury. I'll go by Sarah for my retelling. My husband will be Mark and my daughter, Lily. We also had Bramble, our puppy. And until recently, our home felt like the dream we'd always wanted. I've always been different, sensitive to things others can't see. My grandmother would call it the knowing, some hereditary gift that apparently skips generations in our family. Since childhood, I've felt presences, sensed sorrow before it happened. I've seen dark shapes in my peripheral vision where no one else was there. When I was 13, I foresaw my uncle's heart attack 2 days before it happened. My parents dismissed it as a childhood imagination until it happened, exactly as I described. After that, they never looked at me the same. I remained sensitive throughout my teens and twenties. Once, I refused to board a train due to an overwhelming sense of dread. That same train derailed, injuring many passengers, but thankfully, no fatalities. These experiences were unsettling, yes, but never malicious. I'm not saying this all to brag. I'm saying this because what happened to me is different. It's beyond my imagination. Mark and I met about 4 years ago. This is after I'd come out of several bad relationships. My ex-husband emotionally abused me. The boyfriend following had violent outbursts, once throwing a glass at the wall, and it left a scar above my eyebrow. I began to think I was cursed with men, magnetically drawn to dangerous ones. And then I met Mark. He stood out for his kindness, patience, and optimism. The kind of man who chats to strangers at bus stops and knows all the neighborhood kids' names. He was enthusiastic about life, an infectious laugh. Early in our relationship, he even drove 40 miles at midnight just to bring me a particular Subway sandwich. I thought he was joking, but he wasn't. Within a year and a half, we were married and had our daughter, Lily. Obviously, Mark was the perfect father. Up for midnight feeds, never complaining about nappies, and spending hours reading to Lily in different accents for each character. Life felt suspiciously perfect, especially after everything I'd been through. When Mark got a promotion that allowed him to work remotely most days, he said, "We could move somewhere bigger, somewhere Lily could have a proper garden to play in." Immediately, I thought of Glastonbury. I'd been once before, with work, and I'd felt captivated by the place, the mystique, the energy. "Well, if it makes you happy, it makes me happy," said Mark, kissing my forehead. We found the perfect house online. An early 1800 stone cottage, just on the outskirts of town, with perfect views of the Tor. The listing online described it as having historic charm and unique character. When we arrived, the place felt strangely familiar, but something about the upstairs room gave me pause. The estate agent with us noticed my hesitation. The previous owner was an elderly woman who lived here alone for decades, she explained. She passed away peacefully in hospital and not here, if that's what you're thinking. I was. We moved in during September, as Somerset turned gold and amber. The first few weeks were perfect. Unpacking boxes, arranging furniture, planting spring bulbs. Mark set up his office in a room overlooking the back garden, and I got a part-time job in a local spiritual bookshop. Lily settled in well at the small primary school. Everything was perfect. The changes in Mark were so gradual that I barely noticed them. 3 weeks after moving in, as the October nights grew colder, I sensed his energy shift. His usual passion for life seemed to have faded. He stopped suggesting weekend outings and dinner parties. The man who'd once joked he'd need strapping down to stop socializing began turning down invitations from our new neighbors. When I asked if everything was okay, he blamed work stress or the darker days of autumn. "It's nothing, sir," he'd say, using my nickname. "Just trying to get used to the new role. I'll be back to my annoying happy self soon." And I believed him. Mark never lied. But by November, he'd stop playing with Lily in the evenings. That was their sacred time since she was born. He would lock his study door. When I'd knock and he'd open it, I'd peek in, and he would usually be staring at his computer screen, blankly, or staring out of the window at the empty tour. Lily asked why Daddy no longer read her bedtime stories. I told her he was busy with work, but the look in her eyes was grief. In early December, things escalated. I woke up at 3 a.m., thirsty and confused. Mark wasn't in bed. I found him stood at the top of the stairs, shaking. Even though the cottage was cold, he was only in boxer shorts. "Mark," I whispered, not wanting to startle him. He didn't respond. I approached slowly and touched his shoulder. His skin was icy cold. "Mark, what are you doing?" I asked louder. He turned towards me, and his pupils were so dilated I could barely see the iris. I heard someone calling me," he muttered. "From below, and then from outside. Saying, take them to the stones." To me, this was just the ramblings of a dream. "There's no one else here, honey. Just Lily and I," I said, taking his arm. "You must have been dreaming." He blinked and gradually returned to normal. "I must have been sleepwalking," he said with a nervous laugh, not meeting my eyes. "I haven't done that since I was a kid." By morning, he seemed fine. He made Lily pancakes, kissed me goodbye, and went back to his study. I told myself it was all stress, the new house, new job, an old building with the odd creak. But my first mistake was ignoring my intuition. I don't believe whatever was affecting Mark happened all at once. I think it tested boundaries, slowly, carefully, before it acted. Mark's change in demeanour was so concerning. I arranged for our house to be tested for black mould, carbon monoxide, and other environmental hazards. But everything came back normal. Mark had high blood pressure, but the doctor found nothing else unusual when I forced him to go. There was no history of mental illness in Mark's family, though his mother reportedly had sleep terrors as a child, but they ended by age 10. Glastonbury was unseasonably cold that February. The cottage, whilst beautiful, showed its age with drafty windows and old plumbing. I noticed a sudden temperature drop one evening whilst reading to Lily in her bedroom. It was so cold, our breath fogged in the air, even though the heating was on full. And it only lasted about 2 minutes. It was abnormal. But Mark dismissed it, insisting that historic homes have character. The next day, Bramble refused to go into Lily's room. Instead, he cowered and growled at the threshold, hackles raised. I'd never heard him make any noises like that before. Mark tried coaxing him in with treats, and then Bramble bolted down the stairs. That same night, Lily told me she'd heard scraping sounds from behind the wall. Now, we'd never seen mice, but I told her it must be. It was an old cottage, and that's what it will be. Just to reassure her. These small things, the cold, the dog's behaviour, the scratching, well, I didn't connect them at first. But looking back now, I now know something was infiltrating our home, constantly trying different methods to get through. By mid-February, Mark had stopped eating dinner with us. He claimed deadlines, he barely touched his food, and he'd stare through his plate. His work began to suffer too. Reports were incomplete, meetings were missed, and his usually meticulous approach crumbled. I only know this because even his supervisor called me, concerned. One night, our wedding photo fell from the mantel. The frame shattered in a spiderweb pattern centered around Mark's face. Oddly, it hadn't been near the edge of the mantel. Mark stared at it, disturbed. Then, without a word, he swept the glass into his hand, slicing open his palm. When I reached for his hand to check the wound, he pulled away. "It's nothing," he said. "It's just a scratch." That scratch required 7 stitches at the local hospital. Then came the bathroom incident in early March. I woke up to find Mark's side of the bed empty again around midnight. The bathroom light was on, the door slightly ajar. His voice, low and cruel, was whispering, "You're pathetic. You're useless. They'd be better off without you." I genuinely thought he was on the phone, trying to remain quiet. But when I pushed the door open, he was alone. Stood in front of the mirror, gripping the sink so tightly his knuckles were white. "Mark," I said softly. He didn't respond. I stepped closer and noticed something strange. There was no steam, but the mirror was fogged. And someone had drawn a simple inverted triangle with lines through it. Mark's finger appeared to be wet. "Mark," I said more firmly, placing a hand on his shoulder. He blinked rapidly, startled, and kind of jumped, which startled me, and for some reason had me look at the mirror. And the fog on that mirror was gone. The triangle vanished. "Sarah, what's wrong?" he asked. "You were talking to yourself," I said. "What?" "I was just getting some paracetamol. I heard you talking, not me." "Mark, you were saying horrible things to yourself." He laughed, but it was empty. "You must have been dreaming. Come back to bed." I followed him back to our room, unsettled. He lay on his back and stared at the ceiling until sunrise. I pretended to sleep, but watched him the whole time. Let's take a quick break to tell you about a wonderful product. Did you know there are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our world? From the food we eat to the air we breathe, even the skincare we use, they could be messing with your hormones and making you feel like you're stuck in a mystery of your own. And just like a plot twist in a true crime story or one of those unexpected scary moments in our submitters' experiences, hormonal changes like premenopause or menopause can strike at the most unexpected times. And suddenly you're dealing with mood swings, sleepless nights, and all those other symptoms that make you feel like you're losing control. But here's the good news. This is one mystery you can solve with Happy Mammoth. Just take the 2-minute free quiz from Happy Mammoth, answer a few simple questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can feel like yourself again. The results are impressive. There are over 40,000 reviews on their website. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. According to a survey, 86% of the women started losing weight, 77% say it improved their mood, and the biggest benefit? 100% of the women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DARKPARANORMAL at checkout. That's happymammoth.com, and use the code DARKPARANORMAL for 15% off today.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
That Saturday, I suggested we visited a beautiful gardens area, a place Mark had always found peaceful. He refused, citing work. When I offered fresh air as a cure for his headaches, he snapped. "Stop mothering me, Sarah. Go to your hippie garden without me." Well, I was stunned. Mark had never spoken to me that way. He didn't share my beliefs, but he always respected them. Lily overheard it all. Mark muttered, "Sorry, but there was no real apology. I'm just tired." So Lily and I went without him. And while we were there, I noticed an elderly woman sat sketching the well. Her calm focus intrigued me, and I sat near her. I leant in and complimented her drawing. We got chatting and I mentioned where we lived. "Oh, the cottage on Claremont Hill?" she asked, her tone changing. I nodded, surprised that she knew it. "Well, you've bought yourself a compelling piece of history," she said. "Not all of it pleasant." And then she kept sketching. I sat for a while before pressing her. She hesitated, placed her pencil down, looked at me and said, "Not all energy in Glastonbury is ancient and benevolent, you know. Your cottage sits at the junction of three ley lines, like a kind of crossroads." "Is that significant?" I asked. "Spirit has always gathered at crossroads. It's where the veil thins," she replied. She handed me a card. "My name's Elspeth. I run a small tea shop. Come by if you'd like to learn more." I thanked her as she packed up her drawing equipment, but then walked to the other side of the well and sat back down. So me and Lily just sat and silently watched the fish in the pond. When we got back home, the house was quiet. Mark's car was gone. On the kitchen table was a piece of paper with his scribbled handwriting, "Clearing my head back later." The pressure of the pen had ripped part of the page. He didn't return until after midnight, and he smelled of whiskey. Mark rarely drank, and never anything stronger than beer. So I asked where he'd been. He just said, "Driving." No further explanations. I let it pass. And the following week, things escalated. We both began losing objects that would reappear in impossible places. For example, my car keys, always in my purse, were found in the freezer. Lily's favourite stuffed animal was found turned upside down on the top shelf of a locked shed. Mark lost his wedding ring, and I found it under his pillow. He swore he didn't place it there. Then electronic interference became a routine. Both our mobiles would ring independently with no ID at all times of the morning. If we answered, only static or something that sounded like a vague voice trying to fight through static would come through. Our smart speakers downstairs would suddenly blare out brief fragments of distorted music. The television switched itself on at exactly 3:17 a.m. three nights in a row, always to static. Then came the baby monitor incident. One night it recorded a deep voice, not Mark's. We played it back, and it spoke in a raspy, almost foreign accent, "Choose." Mark claimed he couldn't hear that word and brushed it off, saying it would be interference from another device. Once again, though, when he laughed, it wasn't his laugh. It sounded wrong, stretched. Late March, Mark was sleepwalking again. I woke up and found our bed cold. A familiar dread seized me, and I went straight to Lily's room. Mark was stood in the doorway, staring at Lily while she slept. His body was stiff, unnaturally rigid, like a puppet held by invisible strings. Bramble whimpered and backed under Lily's bed. "Mark, come back to bed," I whispered. He didn't move. Then I noticed his fists were clenched, his breathing shallow. I reached out and touched his arm, and again his skin was ice cold. Suddenly he spun round, his teeth bared, nostrils flared, and his eyes caught the faint nightlight, red-rimmed and unblinking.
"She looks like my dead mother when she sleeps,"
he murmured. But it made no sense because Mark's mother is very much alive. I gently led him away, but his steps were stiff, as though he didn't know quite how to walk. He fell into bed and was asleep instantly. But his breathing changed. It became rhythmic, mechanical, and fell in time with faint tapping sounds that began in the walls. The next morning, I called in sick and I packed a bag for Lily and I took her to Bath to stay with my sister for the weekend. When Mark found out, well, he barely reacted. He just nodded while scratching at his forearm, a nervous habit that had grown worse. His skin was raw. I noticed faint scabs of blood in lines in various areas. While Lily played with her cousins, I went to Elspeth's tea shop. It was tucked away on a side street, and the air was thick with herbs and the scent of old paper. When she saw me, she didn't look surprised. "You're troubled." It wasn't a question. I told her everything. Mark's behaviour, the strange occurrences in the house, my rising fear and dread. She listened silently, making the odd notes. "You mentioned your house is on Claremont Hill." I nodded. "You see, that's a powerful area. The land where your cottage stands once belonged to an Arthur Croft. True or not, your guess is as good as mine, but apparently in the 1800s he was an occultist who believed he could open doorways to other realms. There was once a stone circle on the property, probably gone now, where he purportedly performed these rituals." "What happened to him?" I asked. She paused. "The stories vary. The conspiratorial say he opened a door he couldn't close. Others claim his funeral was a disaster. Most agree he took his own life. He doused the downstairs in paraffin before heading upstairs, taking a seat, and smoking his pipe. After each successful smoke, he would throw the burning tobacco downstairs until the fire started. Your cottage was built later, on that same land, likely on the same foundations." I felt chilled. Do you think our house is haunted by this Arthur?"
"Not exactly," she said.
"More likely the land remembers. Some places are thin. Places where the veil between realities is worn down." "But why Mark? Why not me or Lily? Some people are more open. Has he had any trauma recently, loss or illness?" I thought. "Well, his father died last year, but they weren't close. It did hit him hard, though. He had a minor car accident just before Christmas, but nothing major." Elspeth nodded slowly. "Blood spilt on the land," she muttered, almost to herself. She handed me a packet of herbs for protection and recommended a few books on cleansing. I thanked her, but as I drove back to Bath, I felt no comfort. How could herbs and candles protect us from something that was wearing my husband's face? When Lily and I returned Sunday evening, the house felt wrong, oppressive. Mark met us at the door with a smile that didn't reach his eyes. His enthusiasm was exaggerated. It was like an actor playing the part of my cheerful husband. His night terrors began that week. He would jolt upright in bed, screaming. He said shadowy figures with elongated limbs would stand at the end of the bed. Once he described a tall, emaciated creature wearing a stag skull as a mask. But the worst moment came from Lily. One morning, I found her sitting on the landing at 5 a.m. Bramble sat beside her, his ears pinned back. "Sweetheart, why are you up so early?" I asked. She rubbed her eyes. "The scratchy man told me to come out and play." "What scratchy man?" "The one who whispers through my wall. He says he's Daddy's friend." I checked her room immediately. No one. Nothing. But behind her bed, there were three faint parallel lines through the wallpaper, like something had scraped them with claws. By April, Mark had deteriorated dramatically. He'd lost so much weight. He rarely left the house and often called in sick. I'd catch him speaking in a language I didn't recognize through the locked door of his study. Our guttural, non-English language. He began decorating his desk with feathers, bones, rusted nails. If I asked, he said they were for reference materials for a project he couldn't discuss. Twice in the early hours of the morning, I saw him digging trenches in the garden, burying small bundles wrapped in cloth. It shocked me that I realized I was too scared to ask what he was doing. By mid-April, a foul smell, like rotten eggs, began appearing in different rooms. It would only last minutes, but no matter how much I cleaned that house, the smell would return. Our plants began to yellow and die overnight. Bramble was glued to my side, always a tail tucked between his legs. One morning, a neighbour stopped me as I was walking Lily to school. "Lovely place you've got there. I hope you break the 2-year record." "Pardon?" I asked. "It's just, no one seems to last more than a year or two in that place." I asked if she knew why. She shrugged. "Hard to say. The last long-term resident was that old woman. Bit of an odd duck. Kept to herself. People said she was, witchcraft," she whispered, and then laughed. "But who knows? Did she die in the house?" I asked, remembering the estate agent's vague comment. "She did, the poor thing. Found after a few days. The nephew inherited it, I think, and he put it on the market." I realized there and then just how little anyone knew or wanted to know about the property's true history. And then came the breaking point. I woke up in the middle of the night, heart pounding. Mark wasn't in bed, and his sheets beside me were cold, meaning he'd been gone some time. I rushed to Lily's room. Thankfully, she was asleep, Bramble at her feet also asleep. I breathed out, relieved. But as I turned to go downstairs, the air changed. The nightlight on the landing had gone out, and I was swallowed in blackness. I turned on the torch on my phone and saw movement. Mark was crouched against the wall, but strangely so. The back of his head was the only part touching the wall, and he was strangely using the back of his head to roll forwards and backwards against the wall. And his eyes. When my torch hit them, they were milky white. No pupils, no iris, just blank orbs.
and he was smiling, far too wide.
"Hello, wife,"
he said in a lilting voice that just wasn't his.
"Looking for your husband? He's around."
His tone was childlike and taunting, laced with an accent I couldn't place. This thing wearing Mark's face raised one long finger and tapped his temple.
"He's buried deep."
I froze. My voice caught in my throat. I couldn't scream. I couldn't move. He began to rise, slowly, too slowly, like his bones wouldn't bend the right way anymore. And he was taller than Mark was. His posture, not human.
"We waited,"
it said. "What are you?" I trembled out. It laughed a terrible grinding sound like stone on stone.
"Guess nothing more."
"Leave him alone," I begged. "Leave us alone." The smile dropped, his face twisted, and his voice changed. Lower now, venomous.
"No. Perhaps a trade. You for him, or the daughter of both. A debt is a debt."
Behind me, I heard Lily's door creak open, her tiny feet come down the stairs. "Mummy, why's Daddy sound funny?" The thing in Mark's body turned to her too fast. I lunged, blocking its path, shielding Lily from the sight of this grotesque expression. "Run to your room, Lily! Lock the door!" I screamed. The next moment, a hazy Mark, or whatever it was, collapsed, unconscious. When he came to, he was terrified, confused, no memory of what had happened. I knew his fear was real. I could tell in his eyes. Underneath everything, the real Mark was still in there, buried but alive. That morning, I phoned his mother. By the afternoon, he'd packed a bag and left for Exeter to stay with her. He was trembling, ashamed, but also relieved. His departure was his decision, and that gave me hope. Since then, we've seen each other a few times. He's been himself again, and this house feels quiet. The listing has gone up. It's under offer. A young couple wants it. I've told them just enough to satisfy legal requirements. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell them more. But what would I say? That my husband might have been possessed by something ancient? That an entity spoke through him and threatened our child? They'd think I was mad. Maybe I am. Maybe that's the simplest explanation. In all honesty, it's the explanation I wish was correct. But I know it's not the right one. And it terrifies me to know what I don't know. Thank you for taking the time to read this. Well, Anonymous, thank you for giving us genuinely one of the most thought-provoking and terrifying experiences I've read in a long, long while. The thing that strikes me the most is this happened to someone who doesn't share any sort of belief in your spiritual beliefs. It's not a teenager playing with a Ouija board and getting their comeuppance, so to speak. It's not a regular possession-esque story. And as I said, is it possession or is it obsession? It's really tough to tell, and I'm not going to make a guess. But I will say thank you so much for such a compelling submission. And please remember, guys, when you're submitting your stories, there is a new way to do so, and that is either via the show notes where you'll find a link, or you can visit the website directly, thedarkparanormal.com, and click Submit Your Experience. Our Patreons today realised why that's so important, as, once again, we had somebody ask for their story not to be read out. And doing it in the new way stops that from taking place. So again, you can either submit via the link in the show notes or directly on the website, thedarkparanormal.com. But of course, we need to thank our wonderful team over at Patreon. So the biggest thank you goes to the following.
Rebecca Klassen, CE, Graylin Shea, Sarah Walker, Super Grams, Connor Smith, Chloe Shoemaker, Rachel Marshall, Isabel Garcia, Gina Naranz, Kay Oberlin, Lisa Despain, Missy Quinn Cox, Motion Nunley, Monique Smith, Eleanor May, Rin, Mariah Sandoval, Jamie D, Amanda Deanan, and Alexandra Houston. Thank you so, so much, guys. It is no lie to say that without your support for your show, you would not be hearing my voice right now. So I genuinely mean it. Thank you for the support. And if you'd like to support the show, guys, and get all of those perks we mentioned at the start, head over to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal. But for right now, remember, when you're discussing the paranormal, always leave some of your disbelief at the door. And I'll see you next time right here on The Dark Paranormal.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.